Ireland has, in a global and European context, very low and historically low rates of breastfeeding for a whole host of cultural and other reasons. And to discuss this and mark the beginning of National Breastfeeding Week, joined on the line by Wendy English of the La Leche League in Naas. Wendy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Loud and clear, loud and clear. I suppose we first have to touch on the really complex set of circumstances and reasons why Ireland seems to have a persistently, consistently low rate of breastfeeding.
I think historically the rates did drop here. Obviously going back centuries, breastfeeding was the only way to feed a baby. So, and then when other alternatives came on, people moved on to it, thinking that that was, you know, progress, when actually the evidence shows that breastfeeding is, the normal way, the natural way to feed a baby, and there is no replacement, really. There's nothing that can compare to it. So it's getting people back into that mindset. It seems to be taking a little bit of time, but more and more people are breastfeeding. Definitely, the majority of mums who go into a hospital will breastfeed, even if it's only for a few days. And what La Leche League of Ireland are looking to do is to help mums meet their own breastfeeding goals. So if a mum wants to breastfeed, then knowing where to go for support, that can make the whole difference between her reaching her goals and not reaching her goals. And we just want to support mums in their own personal journey.
And that support is vital, Wendy, because in for most people, in all other aspects of child raising, of welcoming a new baby, they will have family members or close friends who have done likewise, either in the further past or in the very recent present, and will have that bit of wisdom, welcome or unwelcome. But if you're a woman in, you know, her 30s welcoming her first baby, on balance of probability, your mother may not have breastfed, so she can't help and support you with that kind of cultural wisdom that's been handed down through your family to enable you to get through the beginning phase.
Exactly. And a lot of mums do have that support, like they may know a friend or whatever, and we always encourage mums to reach out to others who are breastfeeding. That's what La Leche League is all about. You know, it's a chance to chat to other mums to hear how they got on, hear tips, you know, what worked for them, what maybe didn't work for them, and, you know, how they overcame it. And it means that they feel like they've got a connection and that they know they're not doing it alone, because it can feel very lonely, especially during a pandemic where you're sitting in your house and you're wondering if you're the only person who's ever faced, you know, having a newborn and wondering what to do. So, you know, the fact that we've been doing Zoom meetings since this all started. So La Leche League have run over Ireland. We've had over 300 meetings in the whole of 2020, which, you know, it's a wonderful chance. Every single week, there's at least 4 meetings that are going on, and they're online, so mums can join from their home. They can join, you know, yeah. even in some cases I've heard of mums joining from the hospital. So it's like there's, so even though we've lost a lot by the fact that we can't meet in person, we've gained some as well. So that's really good. And the in-person meetings will be starting again soon. Some of the outdoor ones have already happened, which is really good as well, that people are getting that contact again.
Do you think part of the reason that some women find it difficult either to begin or to maintain the breastfeeding regimen that they would have wanted whilst they were pregnant is the cultural concept of what breastfeeding is? People say it's completely natural, therefore it's going to be easy and instant, and when it isn't, you're taken aback, and that it can take a good few weeks to establish a routine and establish, you know, strong breast milk supply.
I don't know. I mean, every single person's experience is different. So there is an article that was published today in the Irish Times that says that from a lactation consultant, and she's saying that mums, the reason they give up are two reasons: that it's either that they didn't think they had enough milk, or that they experienced pain. And those two things can happen in the early days. So that's where sometimes reaching out for support sooner rather than later, before it becomes a huge problem, can just make that all that difference, because it is incredibly normal for babies to breastfeed very, very frequently. And it doesn't mean that there isn't enough milk, you know.
Well, Wendy English of the La Leche League in Naas, thank you indeed for joining us. Do remember, the lines are always open for your comments, your requests, your dedications, text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. Now, the Irish Postmasters Union is calling on government to create a long-term funding solution in order to ensure the survival of the post office network. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Ned O'Hara. He's General Secretary of the Irish Postmasters Union. Ned, you're welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Delighted to do so. You and I have been talking over the course of many, many years about precisely how to ensure as many viable post offices as is possible stay open. You're back here again. Has nothing happened in the interim that would copper fasten your members' future?
No, absolutely not, Ciara. And like, I begin to sound like a broken record, and it's the same song that we're singing, if you like, all the time. Exactly 12 months, last September, we produced, or got Grant Thornton to produce a report that said the post office network needed an investment of $17 million to keep, to ensure its viability for a reasonable amount of time into the future. We're not looking for secularum commitment. Now, what happened after that is the minister set up an interdepartmental group to look at offline government services, see what offline government services could be delivered through the post office network. And that group is supposed to report by the end of July. Now, it still hasn't reported yet. We're told it's imminent, but it still hasn't reported. In the meantime, we agreed with Unpost. We had a transformation agreement, which allowed us to transform ourselves, if you like, from an old post office model into a more retail-oriented model. And we cobbled up, for want of a better word, an 18-month extension for that to allow this government to produce the report. But our concern now is the report hasn't materialised, nothing has happened, and pardon the cliche, but the government, or this government in particular, must now deliver for the network. Otherwise, people are going to make up their own minds to leave. Like, we, as I said to you, we have a temporary arrangement where we have a solution for 18 months, but if postmasters, and you have to bear in mind that postmasters are independent people who work for themselves, not for Unpost. They do provide 85% of the services, of the post office services across the country. So they're vital to the network. And there are a number of those postmasters who are trying to decide their future at the moment. And if there is no certainty, will they have to give 6 months' notice to terminate their contract? They will start handing in that notice next June/July. And we don't know how many are going to do that, Ciara. We use the term unrestrained closures because we don't know how many. I speak to a lot of postmasters, busy post offices, less busy post offices, and small rural offices. But every one of them, it appears to me, are on the economic margin and are staying in the business for whatever reason. I don't know. But economically, it doesn't make sense for a lot of them. And this is where we're saying a fixed payment would come in. It would allow us to have some certainty in relation to it. Not all our costs, but some of our costs, and allow us to plan. At the moment, we're going to have busy November and December, and we're not sure even at this stage will we be able to afford to hire additional staff. It's the uncertainty that kills us. And the other point I think that should be made, in a week when the Controller and Auditor General made a report in relation to the pandemic unemployment payment and what fall out of that, but there is one sure way that there would be no fraud in the pandemic unemployment payment. If those payments were mandated through the post office network as job seekers, the Controller and Auditor General wouldn't have to do a report to see what side of fraud was in it, because there would be no fraud. You would have to present yourself at the post office to collect your payment. It couldn't be paid into a bank account, irrespective of where you are in the world. So I think,
in fairness to the Controller and Auditor General, I don't know that moving the pandemic unemployment payment to being discharged through a post office would have stopped the powers that be approving a payment for X person who was applying perhaps erroneously, because your members then would not have the knowledge to know that. But that's a tiny, tiny side point.
Tiny, yeah, tiny, no, tiny, having said tiny. That, we do know a lot of our customers, Ciara.
Oh God, there's absolutely no doubt about that. I mean, in an awful lot of places, the post office is the lifeblood, particularly in rural areas or smaller urban areas. But have you come away with the impression, Ned, as you said, you feel like a broken record, you've been saying all of this for years, nothing has happened, that somewhere someone feels that it is desirable that there be fewer post offices?
I think what they would like is if the problem would go away, almost to do nothing about it. And I think from our point of view, the solution is minuscule. Like if the government were to make the investment, and Grant Thornton's figure supported this, there is a return, a social return for the government between 330 and 770 million. I think that people just avoid making decisions and kick the can down the road to avoid making a decision. Now, we want to remove whatever fear people would have in relation to that. For instance, if they thought that they were putting money into a sinking well, I'm not thinking of the correct expression, but like, we're prepared to have it reviewed every two, three, or four, or five years, if that's the case. And we're also mature enough to realise that the world is changing and that we are changing. We have adapted to it. We've adapted during the COVID. We have, and we do deal with people who are often forgotten, the most vulnerable in society. The absolute most vulnerable. I had a case no later than yesterday where a man was gone off to hospital and he got the ambulance to stop at the post office so that he could make arrangements with the person he trusted most so that his affairs would be kept in order to lead him back out of the hospital. And like, I think that's the piece that people sitting behind desks forget. And I think it's easier if you're sitting behind the desk in Dublin not to understand that. But like, we're actually in the front line, and pandemic bonus or whatever they call it, like, we are essential. We provide the service. We want to provide the service. We like doing our job. But all we want is the uncertainty to be removed. And the government could do that. It's a minuscule decision. It's 17 million in a budget of 60, 70 or 80 billion. It's not a percentage. It is buttons in the context of the entire network or the entire budget.
And ultimately, against the cosh here, because there's really only between 6 and 8 months for some kind of decision to be made on this, Ned, before, as you say, potentially hundreds of postmasters begin handing in their 6 months' notice.
Yeah, we'll just take it into their own hands. We can't be expected to continue like forever with no future. Like if we're wanted, tell us we're wanted. And if we're not wanted, tell us we're not wanted. But it's the uncertainty that kills everybody. We can deal with either scenario, but just tell us, make up your mind and tell us. And that's why we say the government has to deliver. Like, I pardon the pun or pardon the cliche, but the government must deliver, and they must deliver now.
Ned O'Hara, General Secretary of the Irish Postmasters Union, thank you indeed for joining us. Today is International Day of the Older Person, and to mark and celebrate this day, I'm joined on the line by Susan Higgins. She's befriending support worker at Older Voices Kildare. Susan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. It's a very important day to mark, but also it gives us a great opportunity to highlight the services that Older Voices Kildare offers to every and all older people in the county. Can you talk us through some of them?
Okay, so at present, due to COVID, we are just supporting people with the befriending service. So that would be receiving a phone call once a week from a volunteer, you know, just to link in with people to help ease isolation and loneliness.
And I would imagine, Susan, that that was greatly utilised since the beginning of the pandemic, with so many older people having to cocoon and so many older people having to cocoon while living alone.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it came in, we jumped from, I can't even remember the numbers now, but it jumped at one point to about 180 calls a week.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so it was huge. And it was just, I suppose, we'd run along nicely just, you know, with the face-to-face visits. And then COVID hit and we certainly didn't know what we were going to do next. But then, you know, you were getting calls from people who had never seen themselves as alone and vulnerable and now were suddenly, you know, being told to stay away from everybody and, you know, stay indoors. So it was like, what do we do? What do we do next? Like, we need to go shopping. We need to, you know, maybe, you know, pick up prescriptions, any of the things they needed to do. So, you know, we were blessed that quite a few volunteers came on quite quickly. You know, once the call went out, people are amazing. And it was just to give people back, you know, something, some kind of human connection. So it was wonderful. It was a wonderful way to see, you know, that people can reach out and help people that way.
And volunteers are the lifeblood of what Older Voices Kildare does. Without those volunteers, you wouldn't be able to offer those services. And if people were engaged in 180 befriending support phone calls every week, that's an awful lot of volunteers giving up an awful lot of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there was people that had maybe 3 and 4 people to call, you know, so we were blessed with the ability of the people to volunteer. There's one volunteer, just again, with the whole keeping it in mind with positive aging, there's one volunteer we have, she'll probably shoot me for mentioning her, but I can't not mention her because I'd be lost without her. And her name is Janet. And Janet herself is 80. And she makes, I couldn't even tell you how many phone calls. You know, she's just wonderful. And it just proves that what, you know, the narrative around the positive aging is that it doesn't matter what age you are, whether you're the recipient or the volunteer. You know, you can still do those things. There's so much there that older people offer that gets overlooked by, you know, the narrative. I mean, research shows that people reach their peak happiness between the ages of 60 to 80. I don't consider that old. In Ireland, it's considered to be very old. And, you know, the reasons behind the happiness levels is, you know, less responsibility, more time, and then to be given, you know, the instruction that you're now not capable, you're not needed, you're not useful. That's awful, you know.
And rather that then the state of life at which you find yourself could mean you're a little bit more vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if anybody listening, Susan, would like to get involved in volunteering with the befriending service or would just like to know more about it, how can they do that?
Right, well, they can contact me. I'll give you the phone number and the email. So the phone number is 087 114 9175. Mm-hmm. And I can be emailed at befriendkildare@countykildarelp.ie.
countykildarelp.ie.
Yeah, now we did, through the whole time of COVID, there was more and more coming up about the effect of the messaging on people. So we did a piece of research with a wonderful researcher called Sarah Stevens, who helped us pull all the statistics and everything together. And, you know, the things that came out of that were amazing and are worth looking at. And mm-hmm. there's a copy of that report. We launched it on Tuesday, I think it was. I don't even know where I am this week. Tuesday, I think it was, in a webinar, which can be found on YouTube, but I don't have a clue how you'd get there. But it's on our website as well, which is oldervoiceskildare.ie.
And could you give us some of the headline results from that, Susan?
So it was the headline results, really. It was just a complete mixture that, you know, treating all vulnerable or older people as a homogenous group was extremely unfair. You know, to tell people they couldn't go and do their own shopping and that they needed to get somebody to do that for them, regardless of their ability, their health, you know, it was literally based on a number that was their age. And then they were cut off from family, friends, neighbours. So any kind of supports they had weren't allowed to go near them. Mm. And they were, you know, they were being told, like, you can't see your grandchildren, you can't see your own children, you can't see anybody. You know, that had a huge impact on the mental health of vulnerable and older people. And then it was like a constant loop on, you know, so people were stuck indoors, so all they could do was watch television or, you know, whatever it was they were trying to do to fill their time. And then, like, I mean, you think, like, the news is on 3 times a day, 4 times a day. So they were getting the same message over and over again. So it became, I suppose, quite scary for people. And there was a huge level of like regression in people's physical ability. So people who had already had challenges before COVID, they were now suffering from muscle wastage, you know, from limited movement. So that it all, you know, it all just kind of started snowballing once you actually talked to people. And the biggest message I think that came out of it was that they weren't listened to as individual people. They were just bundled into this thing and told to stay away from everybody and keep everybody away from them. And, you know, it's all in the research. It's fabulous and it's heartbreaking and all of those things all in one. So it is worth having a look at. Now, I'm not just saying that because we did it, but it's independent of that piece.
It's a valuable piece of research. Well, Susan Higgins, befriending support worker at Older Voices Kildare, thank you indeed for joining us. TDs and senators are being asked to consider rewilding the Dáil car park. It was turned into a car park in about 1948. Originally, of course, that very grand building would have had wonderful, lush, formal gardens front and back. The Taoiseach doesn't seem to be in favour of it at all, while online there's a lot of supporters, but an awful lot of people who are making derisory comments about the plan. And to discuss this, joined on the line by MEP for Dublin, Ciarán Cuff. Ciarán, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Delighted to do so. I suppose that should this proceed, and to be honest, I can't imagine that it would be overly likely in the short term, it would have a number of impacts. One would be it would probably look great, would be aesthetically pleasing. A lot of TDs, senators and their colleague staff would have nowhere to park. But it would act as a talisman to other businesses, other sectors of society to say, this is what the Houses of the Oireachtas have done to attempt in some way to increase biodiversity and reduce their carbon footprint. What are you going to do?
Exactly. And Ciara, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think politicians need to show leadership. And if we're expecting everyone else to try and embrace the challenge of a low carbon economy, we need to do something in our own backyard. And if you look at Leinster House, it's a beautiful building. And on both sides of it, you have the National Museum and the National Library, which attract a lot of tourists, a lot of visitors. And yet, sandwiched between them all, you have a car park and loads of railings. And when you look at these wonderful postcards from two centuries ago, from the 19th century, and you see what was there before, you sort of scratch your head and ask yourself, where did it all go wrong? And look, I'd be the first to admit that there are very practical challenges, particularly for a deputy from outside of Dublin to get up and into Dublin city centre in time for work. But I think it would be no harm, if not to kind of take out the complete car park, at least start the process, maybe nibble away and take out a few car parking spaces every year. And before you know it, after 5 or 10 or 20 years, you have brought the front of Leinster House back to what it was, which was a lovely open area with lots of planting, space for nature, and particularly at this time, these times when we're talking about biodiversity, to just bring a little bit of greenery into the heart of Dublin City could only be a good thing.
And I mean, if this were to come to pass, Ciarán, in an ideal world, would you envisage a formal garden or something a bit more organic?
Well, I think what I've seen doing the rounds in terms of a postcard of what it looked like before, you had attractive green planting in the four corners of the space, and then you had various walkways through the centre. And actually, in the centre of it all, you had a statue of Queen Victoria. Now, I would be the last person to suggest that we bring back Queen Vic. I think she went her way down to Australia about 50 years ago, if not a bit longer.
She did, actually, and I was outside the shopping centre where she currently lives, facing inward. It's an odd place for a statue of that magnitude.
No way.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. Well, look, I'd love to see a woman back in front of Leinster House, but I don't think Queen Victoria would be the first person that comes to mind. Perhaps Countess Markovic or someone like that might be more appropriate. But look, I guess those who wrote the letter and who've approached the TDs, we had the Irish Doctors for the Environment, we have some students from TU Dublin, we have The Urban, a great organisation from my own neck of the woods in Stony Batter. They're trying to start a conversation, just like the wildflower meadow in front of Trinity College.
Mm.
It's not that we want to kind of throw wildflowers everywhere. I think we need to start a conversation about the practicalities of climate action. And I think where we can, we need to cut down on driving and parking. And I know for a dub like myself to be kind of speaking to the people of Kildare and saying we've got to drive less, I'm only saying if you have public transport available or if you have safe facilities for walking and cycling, maybe you could leave the car at home. So clearly you can't do all of this overnight. But looking at places around Dublin, like the front of the Rotunda Hospital, used to have a few car parking spaces, and now it seems to be operating as a public car park. In other parts of Dublin, we had loads of parking. Even up in Dublin Castle, the middle of it was full of cars in the 60s. And thankfully, they've been taken out there. So the OPW actually showed a bit of leadership on that one. But there's many other places around Dublin. And I'm sure in Kildare or in Naas or in towns around Ireland, the car has gradually, you know, a bit like turning on the heat on a pot of water. It didn't happen overnight. It started gradually. But when you look around a lot of Irish towns now, the car has pride of place. And I think we need to reduce the impact of the car a bit. Sometimes it's simply about wider footpaths.
Mm.
Sometimes it's about planting a few trees on the main street. But I do think we need to rethink the role of the car in our lives.
Well,
and
certainly
where we can.
The Taoiseach in this specific context, Ciarán, doesn't seem to be minded to do, because one of the perks of being a former parliamentarian is that you could park at Leinster House. And he seems to feel that it is a way in which to continue to acknowledge their roles as former servants of the people of Ireland, saying, I think we have to acknowledge the role of former parliamentarians played in society and in life and effectively retain their parking. I don't know what kind of perk being able to park when you occasionally head into town for free is.
Well, as a former member of the Oireachtas, I would much rather be remembered there by a tree being planted than a car park with my name on it. You know, I think, you know, for a long time in Irish life, we saw the parking space as the perk of the job, as a sign of status and of having arrived. And now I think, thankfully, we're reconsidering that. I mean, here in Brussels, where I'm an MEP, one of the first things you're offered is, do you want a driver to bring you from the train or from the airport to your place of work? And, you know, to be frank, I don't want to have a heart attack at the age of 60. I want to be healthy. And so I have a bike over here and I take public transport and I get a bit of walking done during the day. And I think we all, most of us need to try and improve our health and fitness.
Mm.
And what better way to do that than by taking public transport and getting a little bit of walking done in between traveling around. I mean, the counter argument is, you know, you lead a busy life, you need to be able to drive anywhere. But, you know, I think that's a bit dated. And I spend a lot of time on trains, on ferries, and indeed on planes. And usually I just take out the laptop and get a bit of work done.
Well, Ciarán Cuff, MEP for Dublin, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up now, the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre has released a new paper within which is a survey showing that 60% of people who reported being sexually harassed were sexually harassed at work. And to discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by the Chief Executive of the DRCC, Nolene Blackwell. Nolene, you're welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara.
I'm really taken aback by the proportion of people who report experiencing sexual harassment in the workplace, but not at the reactions that they may have experienced to trying to shine a light on that harassment. I'm continually never surprised at the amount of heavy lifting the word banter has to do.
Yes, that is 100% true. And it's just one of those things that goes to show that you can have all the laws in place that you like, but it doesn't necessarily change people's minds. It doesn't change their understanding of the harm that is done by sexual harassment, verbal harassment, physical harassment in the workplace, outside the workplace. It is just all of these things that I saw somewhere else, I think in relation to the verdict on Sarah Everard. Mm. Everybody will recognise when the word rape is said that there's something really wrong. But after that, it's kind of on a sliding scale to dismissing harassment in the workplace as trivial, to speaking about it as if, you know, this is the way things are, this is the way things are done. And we, you know, we understand at the other end, because of the National 24-Hour Helpline that we run, we understand that people can really, can be really badly affected. You know, it can affect people's livelihood. It can affect their chances of promotion. It can affect so many things in the workplace, and it can affect their lives then outside of that as well. So when it became clear, like Me Too, when Me Too happened a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago now, it really was about workplaces. At the time, it was people in Hollywood, that movement, actually, the name is older than that, and we can't forget Tarana Burke, who was 10 years before that. But when it came out, it was about people who felt that if they, who believed and who had experienced that if they didn't accept the harassment and the abuse that came their way and the downright rape that came their way, they would not be able to earn their livelihood, or they would not be able to progress their livelihoods. So we kind of just thinking about it and then looking, and we thought, well, look, you know, we have all our policies and procedures here in Ireland, like every workplace has to have them, the policies and procedures. But this survey, now we're not claiming that this is a highly scientific survey. It's not. We just put out our questions on social media. Almost 1,000 people answered. There was a good chance that those who answered were, you know, more interested in the topic than you would have in a random survey. But nonetheless, 1,000 people came back, almost 1,000 people came back to us. And this was their experience, that when it did happen, it was happening in the workplace. And we thought, well, sure, you know, our policies and procedures then can't be good enough if this is happening. And that's when we started doing research into what our laws were, what our policies are in Ireland, added that to our own research, took a look at it and said, I bet we could do better. That's why we're putting out this paper. It's a discussion paper. And we want to take it up with people, maybe unions, maybe employer organisations, employment lawyers, who know, anyone who might help us look and say, is there a way we could make workplaces safer? I mean, you know, in Kildare itself, it's had its own sort of horror story in the past month in relation to the Defence Forces. So every single workplace is vulnerable to running into problems around abuse and harm.
And I would imagine that the experience of those people who are reporting either officially or otherwise sexual harassment in the workplace is greatly disimproved by the fact that the instinct in the general course of events, insofar as we're aware, in a lot of workplaces will be to downplay that experience, to gaslight it, or to just completely ignore it. And then there's also in the workplace the difficulty in its variance, in the fact that workplaces are such a broad church of collective. So it could be that sexual harassment is culturally accepted in workplace X. It could be a cohort working in workplace Y, or it could be one person in workplace Z, for example, all of whom are engaging in this behaviour, but it means tackling it at a cultural level in an individual workplace is all the more complex.
Yes, that's right, Ciara. And that's why one of the things we're looking at is the way that this has always been structured, as this was about a gender equality issue, and it is, there is no doubt about that. But we're looking at it and saying, where there is harm being done in the workplace by sexual harassment, can that place of work be considered a safe place of work? And to go back to what you were saying earlier, it could be, there are some workplaces in Ireland that are downright lethal, totally unsafe. There are some workplaces where everything is safe except maybe for one sloppy bit of it that isn't, that's a health and safety hazard.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just one person who is consistently failing to observe safety standards. But health and safety standards apply in all of those cases and are taken really, really seriously. There are inspections carried out. Places can be shut down if they're not safe places of work. And I suppose one of the questions we will be asking is, are we going too far when we say you cannot say you have a safe place of work if you have a place where people are being harmed through sexual harassment in it? And if that's not an unreasonable, if that's a reasonable enough kind of a statement to make, well then, do we consider allowing sexual harassment or abuse of any kind to happen? Do we consider making it entirely unacceptable as a health and safety standard? And that is one way of changing the mindset, you know. It's kind of like, you know, somebody might throw down a cable in across a room without taping it down properly, but they won't do it a second time because, you know, insurers won't
take it to task.
Yeah, exactly.
There are consequences.
So, and they will learn that way, so that it will co-workers will challenge them, you know. So I think we can do better. You see, I think we have done things like we've established LGBTI champions in workplaces, so that somebody can be comfortable in their sexual orientation and say so without being bullied about it in the workplace. Hopefully, we've done that kind of thing. So I think we can probably do much better now that there's a greater understanding of the harm that's done by sexual harassment. And while it's bad enough in workplaces where people are employed, for people who are self-employed and who may feel that they'll never get another job if they don't condone it, that also has to be addressed.
Well, unfortunately, Nolene, time is against us, but thank you as always for joining us. That is Nolene Blackwell, Chief Executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. And the National 24-Hour Helpline, should you need it, is 1-800-77-8888, 1-800-77-8888.